Once upon a time. Let me do that again. Once upon a time. Well, isn't that the way all the best stories begin? What is it that actually draws us into a good story? Does it have to be set in Wales or Scotland? Does it have to be set right here in Canada? Well, all good stories draw us in one way or another. It doesn't matter if the story is about someone else or just us. Perhaps it's something someone saw, something we did, something we heard or read, oh, however the story came about. We want to tell someone else what we've uncovered. Well, that's if it's a good story. Well, if it's a good story, it doesn't matter if it's spine-tingling, nonsensical, fanciful, or heart-wrenching. It doesn't matter if it's biographical, educational, or thought-provoking. It doesn't matter if it's, excuse me, I'm thinking of a story, and it's hilarious. It could be mind-numbing or whimsical. It will still draw us in, attract our attention, and hold it. Now, if we were to become studious and ask an anthropologist about our love of stories, we would likely be told that storytelling is central to human existence. We would be reminded that storytelling is common to every known culture. We learn that storytelling involves, and I quote, a symbiotic exchange between the teller and the listener, an exchange we learn to negotiate in infancy, end quote. Oh, perhaps that's why two very small little ladies that, well, with whom I'm well acquainted, love to be read to, preferably the same books, over and over and over and over again. Pointing out if I've missed a word and looking for all the familiar things on each page. Stories have recognizable patterns, don't they? And it's in those patterns we find meaning. We use stories to make sense of our world, to share that understanding with others. We know this much about storytelling, that we want to be immersed in it. We want to get involved in a story, to carve out a role for ourselves, and to make it our own. Well, that's certainly about the story that people have been telling for centuries. It's a story in which the bustling city of Jerusalem is shaken by an earthquake, while three crosses sit at the outskirts of town on a hilltop, and the veil in the temple is torn right in two, and a small group of frightened friends hide in an upper room. It's a story with a remarkable ending, a story that actually began at the beginning of time, and it was a story written with you and me in mind, and on the author's mind. We call it the Easter story. We read about it, we sing about it, and sometimes we even act it out. People have written books about it, investigated it, made documentaries about it, even walked the same ancient roadways where the story first played out. Why do we tell it over and over again? Is it because we're afraid we'll forget? No, I don't think so. I think we repeat this story because we're drawn to it. It has all the elements of a bestseller, a simple yet spectacular story. There's a distinctive feeling of needing something from this story, and there is a sense of urgency to tell the story until that need is met. I wonder if this particular story and the urge to tell it over and over is like the notes the postman leaves when you aren't home to receive a package. It's a reminder something wants to be received by you, but you haven't received it yet. Let's call this type of storytelling stubborn storytelling, because it's the type that has something important to tell you. We're going to tell the Easter story again. Yes, again. Now, I know that you know it, and now you know that I know that you know it. And you could tell it yourself quite well, I'm sure. However, I encourage you to listen carefully to what is said and sung this morning. They're stories. And we can learn a lot from a story about belonging, about doubt and hope, about forgiveness and reconciliation. You might not hear those particular words spoken, but I believe you'll come away with a better understanding of what they mean. And perhaps this morning, there may even be a moment when you find yourself in the story. Let's listen. Let's listen carefully. Our storytellers are here.
From wherever you've been, come brokenhearted, let rescue begin. Come find your mercy, O sinner, come kneel. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't heal. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't heal. Hopeless and all those who've strayed, come sit at the table, come taste the grace. There's rest for the weary, a rest that endures. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't cure.
Not so long ago, I used to sit in this workshop and build supper tables. Toys, bird boxes, whatever they'd pay me for, I'd build it. I miss it. I miss the families. Miss the tradecraft. Like this mallet. What an instrument. Simple, elegant, tactile. Gives you all the power, but with the finesse you need for woodwork. Feels like I traded it in for this. The hammer just wants to get the job done. Clumsy, clunky, destructive. Tell that to the Romans, eh? At the rate they bring me split and splintered beams to fix, it's a wonder I can repair anything before they want to nail another man up on them. My wife thinks it's beneath me. When I told her that I'd found new work, a way to pay off our debts, make a new life for us, she didn't say no. But I'll never forget that look in her eyes. That look said it all. It said, the Romans only pay in blood money. Well, I managed my conscience for a while, until Jerusalem was turned upside down by this new teacher. My wife thinks he's the Messiah. I don't know. I heard him speak once outside the temple. Didn't tell my wife about it. Didn't want her to nag me with questions. Tell the truth, the way he ruffled the feathers of those Pharisees, that would have been a sight to see all by itself. But it was more than that. It was his words. They stayed with me. They haunted me. And then, just a few hours ago, I killed him. They, that's a convenient word when you don't want to consider whether you're involved in it. Dozens and dozens of crossbeams must go in and out of that Roman storehouse every single day. The odds that it was one of mine are slim, right? But I can't get over it. I can't get past it. I mean, who could? We all witnessed the aftermath. We all felt the ground shake. We all saw the darkness come down, black like a raven, shadowing Jerusalem like night had fallen. We all heard that the veil in the temple had torn in two, and graves were opening. My fingerprints were all over that cross. I could feel it. Why didn't I listen to my wife? Why didn't I listen to that teacher? I don't know if it's too late for me, but I am done with cross.
Much of what I did on this earth was intended to be significant somehow, to make a name for myself. Even if people cursed it along the way, at least they'd be saying it. You could take one look at me and know. Maybe it was a look in my eye or how I dressed, I'll never know for sure. But it was true. Even when I was a kid, people would whisper about me. Some people even said it out loud. They'd say, look, here comes trouble. How could I argue with it? Every time I came to that fork in the road, I took the path of least resistance. I guess debauchery is another word for it. It seemed harmless at first. First in my head, then in little ways I thought wouldn't matter, until it became my way of life. It became me. I was debauchery. I was immoral, indecent, impure, the one to blame. Condemnation never stirred me much. Oh, my constant compassion, it made sure I knew I was never enough. But shame. Shame was something I hadn't known. I had sufficiently hidden in the shadows. But now I was in the light, looking people in the eye, looking people in the eye as I... That day, all my crimes were listed. First read aloud, then nailed above my head. As I hung there, the pain was agonizing. But there was something that hurt worse. Something that nobody could see. It was the sudden understanding of the person that I really was. The person nobody knew. Or I thought nobody knew. When he said I would be with him in paradise, he looked right into my soul. What else could I do but let him? I could feel myself slipping away. Hope was gone. Any chance to do anything or make amends for what I'd done was over. I was getting what I deserved for who I really was. And there he hung next to me, dying for crimes he had never committed, telling me that I'd be coming with him. Who'd ever told me that? Who'd ever told me in my whole life, you're with me? He knew everything about me, and I knew almost nothing about him. But I believed in him. That was enough. And then, he never let me go.
I've been the object of disbelief my whole life. It greeted me as a child, this disbelief, and it helped itself to me, to my heart, marking me so deeply that, well, you don't know the revulsion people feel towards you until you spend a good portion of your life not being looked in the eye. That was my life until Jesus found me. And what an unbelievable state he found me in. And so we packed, and we cleaned, and we gathered for 3 years, though it felt like only a few days. And then the time came. Well, until his days were accomplished. And he came, and he did what he came to do. If you've walked a life anything like me, you know that sometimes people put on you what Jesus has removed. The first time it happened, he'd only been gone a few days. That mighty, miraculous morning when I went to the tomb and he was very, not dead. He called me by my name, and he gave me very specific instructions. And so I ran to tell the disciples what I'd seen, that he was alive. And they didn't believe me. Had they forgotten? We had stood shoulder to shoulder all this time. I may not be one of the 12. 11 now. But I follow him nonetheless. But you know what? their perception of me was not the image that Jesus saw. I was no longer a cracked and crooked house that demons dwelt in, because the moment I realized that Jesus believed in me, I believed in him. And the disciples came around eventually too. Jesus just kept appearing to a few, then to hundreds. But even after all of that, there were some who didn't believe. He warned us about that. But more importantly, there were others that would never see for themselves, yet still believe. And that's why we keep going until once and for all people can be done with disbelief.
Have you ever had doubts about something? And I'm not talking about your everyday uncertainties. I mean the gut-wrenching fear that you put your faith into something that was just smoke and mirrors. It's the realization that you were willing to die for something, and then the dread that it wasn't real after all. Well, you aren't alone. That's exactly what happened to me. I was one of the 12, a follower of Jesus, and boy was I all in, even ready to die beside Jesus. Me, the realist, ready to jump into the fire with Jesus. It's hard to believe, right? Once, Jesus wanted to go back to Judea when his friend Lazarus got sick. The other disciples quickly reminded him we had just left there because he was almost stoned by the Jews. I told the others we should go with Jesus and die right beside him. Well, we didn't die on that journey. Instead, I got to see Lazarus raised from the dead. What a miracle! You would think that would be enough proof of Jesus' power, right? I was all in. And then he died. And suddenly, everything I thought I knew to be true seemed false. The man who said he was my savior, my teacher, my friend, he was gone. It was not an easy death. He was tortured, humiliated, made to wear a crown of thorns. They took his clothing. Whipped him, and then they nailed him to that ugly cross and put a spear in his side. Nails pierced the hands that had just recently washed my feet. And his mother, kneeling in the crowd, cried. Final breath. You see, he died. So can you understand why I was so full of doubt? I lost hope that day. I was so lost. We all were. Jesus was placed in a borrowed tomb. We were scared and hiding in an upper room,
I left the other disciples for a little while, and when I returned, something had obviously changed. They were excitedly shouting, "We have seen the Lord!" "Seen the Lord? No, that's impossible. He is dead. I won't believe until I place my finger in Jesus' wound, until I touch the spot where the nail tore his skin and the spear gouged his side. Only then will I believe." I was so jealous. You see, whatever happened in that room, I missed it. I missed it. If Jesus had really overcome death and returned to us, why wouldn't he wait for me before revealing himself to the other disciples? Didn't he care about me? If you've ever asked yourself that question, I hope my story helps you. Because 8 days later, Jesus did return to the upper room. And I was there that time. I'm still convinced he came just for me. He called me over to his side and told me to place my finger in his wounds. I reached out my hand and, "My Lord and my God." That's what I said when I touched those scars. It was him. And in that moment, he restored me. You see, most people think my story is about doubt and fear. But I hope you can see it's so much more than that. It's another beautiful picture of Jesus' love for his children. For me and for you. He didn't leave me in my miserable doubt. I wanted to believe. I longed to believe. I couldn't do it on my own. Jesus returned to restore my broken faith. And he'll do the same for you if you're looking for him. Because he doesn't abandon those who seek him. He leaves the 99 to look for the one lost sheep. Are you struggling with doubt? Doubt of his resurrection? Doubt of his love for you? Doubt that he died for you? Look for him. There's no doubt. You won't be doubting long.
Listen, I don't have it all together. My ducks, not in a row. In fact, my row's pretty crooked and I've misplaced most of my ducks. So I'm used to the looks that I get from people when they realize I'm kind of clueless. But sometimes I surprise even myself. Like this conversation I was having with my daughter last week. Now, in my defense, we were talking techie stuff. I get email and I get ebooks, but she was trying to bring me up to speed on some other things, like e-cycle. I think that's like recycling, but with things that aren't real. That seems helpful, right? Then she starts telling me about e-waste. Well, that's when I changed the subject because, ew! So when she asked me about my meal plan for Easter, I started imagining this website where, you know, you stir things electronically, Easter. Well, that's just dumb. So I said, you know what, you're having a virtual dinner this year because I am e-done. She was confused. But she should be used to having conversations like that with me by now. I mean, come on. Anyway. It turns out Easter is actually this holiday that we celebrate every year and not a virtual baking site. But you know, the resurrection of Jesus did
stir things up a little bit, am I right? Oh, thank you. Yeah, she didn't think it was that funny either. But the whole conversation did really get me thinking. Jesus did stir things up. And you know how? He hung out with the mess-ups. The people who sinned the same sin over and over, who made the same mistakes time after time and made promises not to do it again, and then messed up. People who carry shame and regret. People like me. And then he died for them, for us. He took all that sin and shame and he took it to the cross and he paid for it all. Every single mistake. But death did not defeat him like it does us. No, he stirred things up again and he rose again. The resurrection. Easter. So if you're like me and you don't have it all together, your ducks aren't in a row, or you're even more like me and your ducks are dodo birds anyway, I want to remind you today, take heart, because Easter is for people like us. No stirring required.
Thank you. There's joy for the morning. Oh, sinner, be still. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't heal. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't heal.